became like his art slave. He kept her basically locked up in a room with the curtains closed, just churning out these paintings 16 hours a day while he was outside, you know, swimming naked in the swimming pool with naked women and Howard Keel and the Beach Boys. And she was inside, you know, like an art slave, churning out these paintings for him.
That was writer John Ronson talking about Margaret Keane, who was forced to paint those iconic big-eyed children paintings for her husband, Walter. We'll hear more from Ronson later in the show. First, Republicans' takeover of the Senate has been the national political story of the week. But meanwhile, voters here elected a new leader for a swath of L.A. County that's bigger than many congressional districts. Former California State Senator Sheila Kuehl replaces Zev Yaroslavsky next month as the L.A. County Supervisor representing the 3rd District. It is a huge area running from Santa Monica to Hollywood to the San Fernando Valley with more than 2 million constituents. Sheila Kuehl joins me now. Welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited and very happy.
Great. Well, what is your number one priority?
My number one priority, it would be 1, 2, and 3 in no particular order because, as you know, the county does everything that people actually don't know it does, but everything a state does. So my number one priority, foster children, and frankly, children's welfare in the county, health care across the board, mental health, public health, and what people call health care, and of course, transportation. I want us to be able to get not only everywhere on light rail, but get to light rail and back home easily as well.
Well, let's start with that one first, transportation and the Purple Line subway extension. People in Beverly Hills do not want it to go under Beverly Hills High School. And you have said that you're open to changing the route. Why?
Well, I'm open to talking to the parents, the school board, and the city council, of course, in Beverly Hills, all of whom don't want this route to go under the high school. But as I've told them, I think that actually that horse is out of the barn. It's going to have a stop at Constellation. That's pretty well set. Federal funding has come in that way. But there is a possibility, because they were talking about not having it go under the buildings, but rather under the field, which they feel could be perhaps a little bit safer. All I said was, I think it's important to sit down and talk to people because the lawsuits are going to hold it up. Might as well sit down and talk.
So you think you might avert some of the lawsuits by having these conversations?
Never can tell. I just think people sometimes need to be heard.
Okay, let's take on the foster care system that you talked about. It's your number one, although, as you said, not in any list of priorities. But your first thing that you mentioned, the county's foster care system, it's had horrible lapses in recent years. A Blue Ribbon Commission was put in place to suggest some reforms. What changes are you going to push for?
Well, the Blue Ribbon Commission did recommend sort of realigning the county departments that serve children so that they could all be under one director that the press, of course, calls a czar. And I really want to continue that work. In terms of what can be done, the caseloads are incredibly high for social workers and for the support for social workers. And though the training has improved over the years, it's just too much.
Well, one of the things that could be done is raising their salaries. Would you consider that as a possible solution?
Well, as you know, there are negotiations by representational units for all of the county employees, and that all has to be taken in context. So certainly when they talk about contract negotiations, I think one of the reasons that labor was enthusiastic about me, I might add for the first time in any race that I've ever run, is that I'm very fair in negotiating. I understand what working men and women need. And I think people would be open, but there's a lot more that needs to be done than just higher salaries.
All right. You raised the issue, your support from public employee unions. Your campaign received $3 million around.
My campaign committee did not receive, because, as you know, there are caps on that.
Right.
There was an independent expenditure.
Okay. So $3 million from labor was spent on your campaign.
Okay.
Okay. So some people have said, including your opponent, Bobby Shriver, that it would be impossible for you to distance yourself from them once you're in office, especially now that contracts are expiring at the end of the year for the sheriff's deputies and the firefighters.
Well, do you want to tell me what the budget shows me for next year and what's possible?
I have no idea.
Yeah, well, there you are. I mean, people kind of want to ask you, and would you put, you know, another ounce on this scale? It's a much bigger scale than that. The these two, the deputies and the firefighters, contract is up the end of the year. I don't even know what their requests are all going to be. Everybody focuses on salary, but there's a lot of working condition requests as well. And so what you do is you take it all into account, you look at the budget, you look at the money coming in, and you see what you can do. What I don't like to do is impose top-down solutions like take it or leave it, you unions. No. The notion is bargaining. That's it. Negotiation. That's what organized labor is for.
And do you think that the county has the wiggle room financially to do that?
It could. There's a lot of other contracts coming up in 2015, and I think it all has to be balanced out. But I think people do understand that public safety workers enter into harm's way every day. And also, if you want to make improvements in the jail, you have to make improvements in training. And interestingly enough, some of what the deputies are asking for is better training, not just money.
What do you think of the money that was allocated to LACMA for a new museum redesign?
I love it. I'm really happy. This is such an amazing arts community. And, you know, people who were carping about putting too much public money into the building before we got any, art or spent money on art. Well, what Michael Govan wants to do is not spend money on art, but go to Jerry Parenchio, i.e., and, you know, suddenly we've got his entire collection, which is worth more than all the money we're putting into the museum. But there has to be a great place to put the art. I like the idea of being able to see much, much more of our collections in the new building, and I'm very enthusiastic about it.
Okay, we're going to talk to Michael Govan in just a minute. Sheila Kuehl, new L.A. County Supervisor representing the 3rd District. She takes office next month. Congratulations, and thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Madeline. It's a pleasure.
And as promised, here is Michael Govan, director of LACMA. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thank you. How are you? More to the point, you announced earlier a major gift to LACMA, $500 million worth of art from billionaire Jerry Parenchio. And what was it like to get the call from him? Was it out of the blue?
No, it rarely happens out of the blue. This is a long discussion, and somebody who's lived in Los Angeles for a long time, who's been very successful, and I think had always wanted his works of art, he calls them his children sometimes, to be available to the public. He wanted an institution that was worthy of it, that was growing. He wanted an institution with a facility worthy of it, and I think all the movement that's happened in recent years, the doubling of attendance, new facilities, and just yesterday, and as you heard from Supervisor-elect Kuehl, the sense that the government here is a holistic thinking group, and they are willing to support a new LACMA and take care of the aging facilities that they own.
Yeah, so they allocated $125 million towards this project, $600 million project. And isn't there a big string attached to this collection from Jerry Parenchio that you have to build this Peter Zumthor design in order to receive his collection?
Yes, he wanted to know that we would have a facility. He was very excited about the new facility and that we would have really someplace world-class for not only his collections, but all the diverse collections that we have. And we've been talking for a long time. He feels also that this community is ready, and with the county's cornerstone support, and remember, this is probably the largest private amount of money that will be raised to renovate a county-owned facility. So it really is, talk about public-private partnership. You couldn't ask for more. And of course, the benefits, yes, there's economic impact benefit and tourism and all that, but it comes down to walking in and seeing that beautiful Monet water lilies or the Picasso drawing or the Bonnard painting. That's what's so magical. That's what educates and that's what inspires people is the art.
What is the standout piece in his collection?
I mean, there's so many. To look at the plein air paintings of Monet, and I say Monet is, you know, the painter of light, but you can draw a direct line from that to say the James Turrell, a Los Angeles artist that's on view, an artist of light. This Picasso drawing of of 1909 is like you can see Cubism being born. There's a lot of pictures. There's Toulouse-Lautrec. There's Vuillard. There's a little bit of an undercurrent of pictures of performance and even showbiz, which I think is appropriate for Mr. Parencio since he came from that world. I don't know. There's so many standouts. The Magritte alone that was in the paper today is it will be worth the trip.
Yeah. Okay. So you're going to show them presumably in this new Peter Zumthor designed building, correct?
Yes. The idea is that he has offered a chance for us to take some of the highlights and put them on view probably this spring, potentially in coordination with our anniversary, so the public will have a taste of that. And then, of course, the idea is you'll see them in bits and pieces, but that they are directed to the new facility.
Right. And so you need to raise, what, $475 million more?
That's right. And we can do it.
You can. In how many years?
You know, we've already raised $300 million for the facilities you've seen. It's not endless. It's very hard work. And, of course, people have limits on what they can do. A lot of these people give to other philanthropies and other causes as well. We've analyzed this carefully. We think that's the right number. We've done the cost estimates on the building. You know, it would be given over many years. The second part of the county finance piece is financing over 30 years, $300 million, so that the private people can give their gifts over many years, which is what they will do. And so we are sure, as Mr. Parencio said today, failure is not an option.
Okay, and let's talk about the design itself because it's somewhat controversial. Some people really like it. Other people really do not like it. They call it an oil slick. And, you know, some critics have just not been kind about the design itself. They don't like it, and they don't think that it represents what LA should represent at its best.
Actually, some critics have also been exuberant about it, and it is LA at its best. There are two features of the building. If you say oil slick, the reason is that it's covered in solar panels, and so that's why it's dark on its roof, so that it can soak up the sun to be a sustainable building. That makes a lot of sense. I think that represents LA. The curvy lines, remember the galleries inside will mostly be rectilinear, but part of the curvature not only deals with the obstacles on the site, but it's a museum without a particular front or back. You can come at it on any direction. For me, that's so key that there's no front, no cultures in the back, no cultures in the front. That seems to me the values of Los Angeles. And in addition, the museum is almost entirely transparent, see-through, accessible. You can walk through the park and see inside instead of it being behind a wall. I would say that's a value of Los Angeles. So I would argue it embodies the best of Los Angeles.
And it goes across Wilshire.
And it goes across Wilshire, so it engages the street. You'll see up and down Wilshire. And you know what that does? In addition, it takes 100,000 square feet of building program out of Hancock Park, gives it back to the park, and puts that on additional private property that museum associates have bought. So it increases the park space and creates a bigger landmark.
Now, I think a lot of people are saying, why didn't you choose? There are plenty of talented architects here in Los Angeles. Why did you choose an architect from Switzerland?
Well, it's a global field architecture. Everyone knows that. Architects work all around the world. That's the nature of things. Architects in Los Angeles are working in Europe, in the Middle East. Why don't they pick Middle East architects instead of Frank Gehry? I worked with Frank Gehry very closely on the Guggenheim Museum Bilbao. He has his spectacular Disney Hall. In fact, that's where I learned to love L.A., was working in Frank's studio on that project for Bilbao. And I think that idea of a globalism of architecture, there's a great tradition of it. Peter Zumthor is an architect. He's built two museums, and the most specific feature is that every building looks different because it responds to its particular site, and this is a very special site between Wilshire Boulevard, existing buildings, and the primordial La Brea Tar Pit. So he's probably the most site-specific architect and therefore the best suited, given his two extraordinary museums already, for this particular project.
Yeah. Well, I think some people would say the reason would be because this is a county museum. This is a symbol of Los Angeles. It's not just any old building designed by any old architect. I mean, this is something that has public in its very DNA. And so therefore, maybe there should be some, some precedence given to an LA architect for that reason alone.
This is a international, it's a global city with many cultures. We could just as easily justify a European, Latin American, Asian Los Angeles architect. I don't think we want to see ourselves in a provincial sense when every other city in the world is looking at a global picture in terms of art and architecture. It's a beautiful thing to have the openness. And remember, this is a collection. We happen to have the best collection of Los Angeles artists and design, but we're also a global museum. And I think the idea of a museum, the building itself is a frame. It has to be the best frame. The art's what's most important, as you kind of saw this morning, how people are inspired by the art.
Michael Govan, CEO and Director of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline.
If you want to see a rendering of the new LACMA design, go to our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. And lots of people are weighing in there on the design, what they think of it. Let us know your thoughts, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the Sklar brothers are here. They'll weigh in on the hapless Lakers and what Jose Canseco was doing, cleaning his gun. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and let's talk some sports.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
On today's agenda, short referees, accident-prone ball players, and a sad champion who wasn't allowed to ride a horse. Joining me now to fill us in on all these stories are the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. They host the podcast Sklar Bro Country. How you guys?
We are good.
We're great.
Hi, how are you? I don't even know if you asked us if we're good, but we're just like, we're
Hi,
good.
How are? Whatever.
She did.
Same
she said
thing.
She asked.
Okay, let's talk about the Lakers because we have to.
0-5,
okay,
perfect
okay,
record
we're
so
done.
Far.
Perfect, I know.
Or they're done.
Well, here's the thing. Here's a stat about the Lakers. They have given up 116 points per game, which is 30th in the league out of 30 teams.
You cannot win if you do not play defense, and you can have Kobe scoring 40 points a game,
which he did the other night. Scored 39 points,
and you're still aren't lose. Going to win. I mean, they lost one of their best prospects, Julius Randle, who injured himself in the first, literally the first game,
broke his leg, and he's out
for the year. And that's just a terrible thing because he would have brought a lot to the team. A lot of people felt like he was a great sort of small forward,
uh-huh.
But you know, look, that happens in sports. It happens. You have to be able to adjust, and the Lakers just can't seem to adjust. You know, the coaching thing is a little bit, can Byron Scott get these guys to play defense? And he was actually a pretty good defensive player when he played for the Lakers. So it's a little bit like, what is happening here? And you can just see Kobe, who is this, you know, in his heart of hearts, a champion, just literally melting in front of us.
This was foretold, was it not?
It was.
And a lot of people blame him. They feel like he took the maximum money contract because he worked and earned his whole career to do that, but it didn't leave a lot of money on the table to get other players.
Other players were saying that a lot of people weren't choosing to want to play with Kobe. So the Lakers made a choice. They went with Kobe, and now, look, they're 0-5. So
what about the Clippers, though? They got killed last night.
Clippers got killed last night, which really just tells you they played at Golden State, and Golden State is tough. I mean, they've been really good. They made the playoffs the last several years.
They're 4-0 right now.
They're unbelievable. I mean, that's the West is just, it's a beast of a conference. You've got Houston that's undefeated. You've got Golden State that's undefeated. You've always got the Spurs. They're always amazing. You have to go through so many teams in order to make it out of the West that they're going to sort of knock each other off, and it just shows you how difficult it is to be great in that league, as opposed to the East, which, by the way, in the East, LeBron James and the Cavaliers lost on a last-second shot to Utah last night. Utah is not a great team.
They're 1-3.
Oh, Utah is 2-3, but now the Cavs are one and three. And apparently, you know, LeBron came back to Cleveland. They got Kevin Love as a great piece, and you feel like, all right, Cleveland's actually going to make a championship run. That's what everybody says. They're contenders now. They're not playing together as a team. They had Kyrie Irving, who's their point guard, who's a guy who should be distributing the ball, 34 points last night,
zero assists.
Zero.
So who's a good team we should be following?
Well, I mean, I think Houston has got a lot of pieces. They're really good. They're 5-0. Obviously, we were mentioning Golden State. They have a lot of pieces. They're really good.
And the Clippers. The Clippers are a team that if they put it all together, they have the coach who can coach them in the postseason. You know, this is a good possible year for the Clippers. So LA fans, do not despair.
Do
Don't
not
put it all
despair.
On the Lakers.
Unless the games are being officiated by a short referee.
Yeah, this report came out. I read this whole thing. This is fantastic, that apparently shorter referees
call more fouls.
A few percentage points more fouls than their taller counterparts. A lot of research was taken about this.
And How short is short?
Well, they divided the measurings to 6'3 and above, 6 feet to 6'3 and under 6 feet. And the under 6 feet group of refs
tended to call like more than
0.14 fouls per game as opposed, or in certain situations in comparison to the other ones. It was a situation where there are a lot of theories. Like some people are saying maybe because they're shorter, they had a better angle of the action, they could call fouls better.
Which I don't know if I really agree with that, because I think you're amongst the trees. The taller you are, the better perspective you have. the other sort of theory that's been kicked around is that, look, these guys are short. There's a little Napoleonic complex
yeah.
there, and you're amongst a lot of big guys, and you want to assert yourself. So they tend to be a little more whistle-happy. Who knows what it is? To me, I think tall people, and this is a true stat, that the taller presidential candidate has always won. People love tall people. So, like, I feel like tall people have it great in life. They literally are like, why am I? I'm happy.
Why am I going to blow a whistle,
on this guy? Go ahead, travel a few steps.
So
I'm
the
fine.
Gentle giant is alive and well, is what you're saying?
Maybe. I don't know. But it is worth, like, I think where you really find is
technical fouls,
which are not, those are more judgments sort of on behavior. And if, you know, we sort of do a sort of an in-depth study about are the shorter referees calling more technical fouls, then you might there might be some sort of weight to this whole Napoleonic thing.
Okay. The World Series is behind us.
Maybe you're breathing
a sigh of relief.
Well, if you're LA fans,
and then you weren't fans of the Giants, right?
Well, we weren't either because we were St. Louis fans, and the Giants sort of ran through us. And this is the third World Series they've won in the last 5 years, every even year, 2010, 2012, 2014. It's unbelievable. It's amazing because they didn't really have the best regular season record, and they didn't really dominate.
They were a wild card team.
They were a wild card team, and then they sort of blew through everybody, and they did it on the strength of a great starting number one pitcher, Madison Bumgarner,
who was the MVP.
He was the MVP. The guy comes in Game 7 and pitches
on 2 days rest.
Pitches five scoreless innings of beautiful baseball to carry them through in a very tight game. I mean, this is a guy whose arm should be dead at that point, and he is literally still throwing
gas. So is he given
gas.
The keys to the city? Does he get everything he wants?
Well, he should be allowed to ride a horse in the parade.
He asked. He flat out asked a policeman, I want to ride that horse. Can I ride that horse? And the cops said no.
Cops said no.
Wait,
you
was
don't
the cop
deny.
On the horse?
Yeah. Yeah, you don't deny Madison.
Well, they came up with a compromise. They said you can sit on the horse and we're going to take a picture with you on the horse, but you don't get to ride the horse because they didn't want to be responsible if the horse went crazy, threw him off, he injured his arm.
I know, because they know
That's the golden ticket
he's
right
there. Going from the standpoint, the police are, that like we understand the value of Madison Bumgarner. We don't want to be the reason he's like having reconstructive Tommy John surgery because he got tossed from a horse.
Also, you think he could buy his own horse and ride it whenever he wants.
Yeah, he's also a country boy. You know what I mean? He kind of has that sort of southern drawlish type thing. You know?
I think he knows his way around.
He's been around a horse, all right. You know, it's not like the first.
You think
time.
He should have been allowed to ride the horse?
Yes, he is. You should allow him to do whatever he wants. If he wants to ride the horse inside of a building, let him do it.
Yes.
If he wants to ride the horse like inside of a bar, he won the World Series for you.
You should have 10 cops around the horse with pillows.
And
just giant
in
pillows.
In case he gets thrown, he'll fall on a nice pillow. That's what the cops should be doing in that instance.
Okay.
Instead, they were like, you cannot ride on this horse.
He's like
an 8-year-old child.
Well, rules are rules for a reason.
I guess
for everybody.
I guess so.
Jose Canseco, speaking of baseball.
And speaking of rule breaking.
Yeah.
Shot off his middle finger while cleaning his gun in Las Vegas. What's
the symbolism of
that? I'm not a gun owner and I'm not a gun person. Yeah, what is the symbol of that? You know, but I would say that shouldn't you check to see if there are bullets in the gun before start cleaning?
If you are taking the time to clean a gun,
if your to-do list says clean gun,
you should also have enough time to check to see if bullets are in the gun.
Nobody's like, clean, honey, I got to take the kids to school. I'm just going to clean. Well, who knows? He said he was cleaning it, but it just shot off his middle finger, which again, it's of all the injuries, he's not deaf, he's not blind, he can
doesn't
still
affect
walk.
His balance.
He just can't maybe text as fast
or tweet.
What did they do with the finger? Did they sew it back on?
With the finger, I think you keep the finger and you figure out what planet Hollywood is that finger going to go to and just sit in the case right behind the hostess desk.
Randy and Jason Sklar, the Sklar brothers, and check out their stand-up special, What Are We Talking About? It's on Netflix and iTunes. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Coming up, longtime Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman is here. He's retiring after spending more than half his life in Congress. We'll find out what he makes of the new power structure in Washington after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman is retiring after 40 years in Washington. His district largely encompasses the west side of L.A. and from Malibu on down to the South Bay. Voters have chosen another Democrat, Ted Lieu, to replace him. Congressman Waxman stopped by our studios here at KCRW, and I asked him what the future holds and how he felt about Tuesday's election results.
Well, I was very pleased at Ted Lieu's victory and Sheila Kuehl's and Ben Allen. Those are the three candidates in our local area, the three that I endorsed, and I was very pleased with their wins. And, of course, we did well in California for the statewide offices. But it was a disappointing election. All over the country, not only were Democrats losing, but people I knew to be really terrific public-interested representatives were going down to defeat. In Colorado, Udall's defeat, he's such a terrific person, and it's a real loss. Sometimes you look at a Democrat and Republican, you say, well, it's one less for the party. But I know some of these people, and it's more than just one person because of what they mean and what they do and argue for as a representative, or in this case, in the Senate.
Well, speak about the president, because he's getting some criticism from members of his own party for not campaigning well enough for Democratic candidates on the ballot, for not spending enough money, raising enough money, I should say, releasing the money in time to help some of these candidates when they were in trouble. How do you rate him in terms of how he helped or hindered his party in this election?
I think the president's being unfairly criticized. Some of his policies are not popular, like the Obamacare, but if you call it the Affordable Care Act and covered California, it's quite popular. If you talk to the 10 million people who have gotten insurance that couldn't get it before, they like this law. Even in Kentucky, where Mitch McConnell sailed to reelection as one of the strong leaders against the Affordable Care Act, in that state, it's very popular, and people have benefited because they had a Democratic governor that put it put the whole thing in place.
But could he have done more or done things differently have changed the outcome, do you think?
I don't think so. It's hard to criticize him for not being out there to campaign for Democrats who say, please don't come to my district and campaign for me.
But what does that tell you, then, about his popularity with the Democratic base?
He did what he could to get the vote out. So he was campaigning in areas where he was hoping to get the African-American and Hispanic vote increased at the polls. But I think he's been a good president for the most part, and I don't think this reflects badly on him.
Well, you know, looking forward to the next 2 years, what can you predict as someone who will be on the sidelines but will know the players and will know what's going to be happening in Washington? There's been a lot of gridlock since the president was elected. And now that Republicans control both houses, will there be even more gridlock, or is there an incentive for the two sides to work together and get something accomplished, do you think?
The last 4 years, at least, the Republicans in the House, where they have had the majority, took the position they could do whatever they want, just send out messages, repeal all the environmental laws, attack Obamacare and try to repeal it. Not one time, but 50 times we voted to repeal it. They have been passing bills that are messages to their narrow conservative constituents to show we're fighting for their cause, knowing full well it wasn't going to be law. Now they have control of the Senate, and people are going to look at the Republicans and say, are you going to be able to govern? Are you going to be able to get things done? Can they get together? They have more right-wingers in the House. The Tea Party faction became the majority faction. John Boehner, as the Republican speaker, couldn't get the votes, even though he had a majority, for whatever he wanted to do. And they left things unresolved. Now they'll have to compromise among themselves to get a Republican majority. But then to get something into law, they're going to have to compromise with the Democrats and the president.
What about the Keystone Pipeline? Do you think that there will be some movement there, or that is something that President Obama has indicated that he might approve?
Well, it's up to President Obama to make a decision about the Keystone Pipeline. But if he's not for it, I have no doubt the Republicans can pass a bill. But
how do
Republicans,
you feel about that?
I think it's a mistake to have the Keystone Pipeline. It's going to increase the amount of emissions that cause climate change. But the big action on climate change is going to be within the administration. The president has no hope to get a bill through Congress. The Republicans deny the science. They deny the existence of climate change. They're not ready to do anything that the coal and the oil industries are against. But the president has a lot of authority under existing law to act on his own. He's going to use that authority, at least I hope he will. So far he's indicating he will, and he's doing so with the power plant rule. So the pipeline, they'll make partisan. The efforts to deal with climate change, they'll make partisan until the American people start saying, wait a minute, we're seeing unusual freakish weather patterns, and denying the science and having no alternative isn't a solution.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Congressman Henry Waxman. He's retiring after 40 years in Congress in Washington. And when you were first elected, you were one of the Watergate babies, as they call them, elected,
right.
The class that was elected after the Nixon Watergate scandal. And there was a lot of activism that happened in those days in Congress. And as we've been talking about, there's been a lot of inaction in Congress these days. And so are you leaving with, I don't know, a little bit of, on a down note?
I'm leaving with a really good, solid feeling about our legislative accomplishments. People take for granted laws that were passed, sometimes after big fights. And a lot of those laws that I authored are very popular. We authored the Clean Air Act. If you go out in Los Angeles, you see clean air. Some of us who have lived here all of our lives remember the days when kids couldn't play outside. We have cleaner and healthier air. We're tackling toxic pollutants that cause real problems. The acid rain problem is no longer the problem it once was. So there's a lot that's been done with the Clean Air Act. The Affordable Care Act is giving people an opportunity to be able to get health insurance for the first time. We've passed legislation for children's health coverage, both under Medi-Cal and what's called the CHIP program. I authored the HIV/AIDS law. I authored legislation dealing with tobacco, fighting against the tobacco industry from targeting our kids. We passed laws for women to be given special attention in clinical trials, and more to be done to stop breast and cervical cancer. We have cheaper drugs as a result of the Hatch-Waxman law. So I look with pride at the laws we were able to pass. Almost all of them, except for the Affordable Care Act, had bipartisan support.
You were one of the main authors, the main proponents of the Affordable Care Act, and got it through when the Democrats were in the majority. And yet you didn't get a single Republican vote on that. Do you now, looking at how the Affordable Care Act has been attacked by Republicans and used in campaigns, do you regret that, not being able to get any Republican votes on the Affordable Care Act?
I always regret it when we don't have bipartisan support. But the Republicans made a clear decision. As soon as Obama became president, they were going to be against everything he wanted. They were against the stimulus bill for the economy, even though Republican and conservative economists said we needed it. They were against the Affordable Care Act, even though it had a lot of their ideas. They were against the legislation to regulate the Wall Street abuses. They were just against everything. Even Mitch McConnell said in 2010 that their job was to bring Obama down. Well, they haven't been able to do it. He's in for two more years. He's the president of the United States. So he still has a big say over what's going to happen in the next couple of years. And if the Republicans look like they're still the party of no, that in a presidential election, if they're not for immigration reform, if they're not for dealing with the problems of our economy and what the American people want done, I don't think they're going to be rewarded in the next election when people are really paying attention. Presidential elections are about the future. Congressional midterm elections are about the grievances people have. And 6 years in a president's term, all the grievances come to a head and people generally vote against the president's party. That's what they did this time. 2 years from now, it'll be very different.
So now what are you going to do? Now that you're leaving, what are you going to do with
all
your time?
Well, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to figure that out. I have a job at least at the end of this year. In fact, legally, and I'm not out until January 2nd because the new Congress is sworn in on January 3rd. I'll look around. I want to be involved in some of the issues that I've been fighting for, the environment, the health issues particularly, and we'll find a niche.
Would you ever consider being a lobbyist?
The idea of being a lobbyist sounds so awful, but if I were a lobbyist for the environmental side of things, if I were a lobbyist for good health programs, if I were a lobbyist for good laws, that doesn't bother me. If I'm an advocate, and that's what I've always done, is be an advocate. But I don't want to be a lobbyist to sit outside the doors of my colleagues and ask them to vote for some special interest proposal. So that's not for me. I am a lawyer, so I could practice law. I'm interested in health and environmental policy, so I'm looking at investment firms that are looking for new opportunities. I want to work with the environmental community and the public health side of things. As a volunteer on these boards, that'll all be put into place as we figure it all out.
Well, Congressman Henry Waxman, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
And Warren Olney joins me now to preview 1 o'clock and To the Point. Hello.
Hello, hello. We have all been distracted by the elections, of course,
indeed,
and forgot about Vladimir Putin. So we're going to talk about Vladimir Putin today, who has been very provocative of late, even sending planes capable of carrying nuclear weapons all the way to Portugal and going along the boundaries of NATO countries, causing NATO countries to send jets up in the air and discombobulating everybody. It's a very interesting situation, very challenging, and there's a lot of dispute about what's best to do about it. We're also going to hear Harry Shearer do Richard Nixon.
That I want to hear.
It's good stuff.
You've got a good impression. Mm-hmm. Warren Olney and To the Point coming up at 1 o'clock. And on this show, right before then, the story of Margaret Keane and the paintings she did of those big-eyed children for years. They were hugely popular, and her husband took all the credit. She did all the work. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play from KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The story goes something like this. An aspiring artist goes to Berlin right after World War II. He sees doe-eyed children rummaging through the trash for food, and he's so affected that he starts churning out paintings of these wide-eyed children. The paintings touch a nerve with the American public, and he becomes a millionaire from selling them. Well, according to my next guest, Walter Keane perpetuated one of the biggest art frauds of the 20th century. John Ronson recently wrote about the true story behind Walter and his wife, Margaret Keane, and he's here now. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, so as I said, this begins just after World War II in Berlin. A young Walter Keane, he's trying to become an artist, and then what?
So he sees these big-eyed children with running noses, you know, scavenging around for food in the debris of post-war Berlin, and it tears his soul, and it's the moment he becomes a great painter. That's his story. 10 years later, he's exhibiting his big-eyed art at an outdoor art fair when a woman comes up to him and says, you know, your paintings are the most beautiful paintings I have ever seen. They've touched my soul. You're the greatest painter of eyes since El Greco. I want to touch your paintings. And Walter says to her, never touch my paintings. And then he wrote about all of this in his memoir, The World of Keane. And then that night they made love, and Margaret told him, you are the greatest lover in the world. And then they married.
Of course.
All of this is in his memoir. and so cut to a couple of years later, and Walter is selling his paintings at this beatnik club in San Francisco called The Hungry Eye.
Uh-huh.
And one day Margaret, who's now his wife, goes along with him to The Hungry Eye and sees him selling the paintings. And somebody comes up to her and says, do you paint too? And this kind of horror crosses her face, because she had painted every single one of the big-eyed paintings. Walter may well have seen big-eyed children in post-war Berlin, but he hadn't painted any of them because he didn't know how to paint. He couldn't paint to save his life. Margaret had painted every single one, and Walter had been going around San Francisco telling everybody that he was the artist.
And she didn't know that he was doing that?
No. So that night she confronted him and told him he had to stop. But then something else happened instead, which was for the next 10 years, Walter Keane became one of the most successful artists in America. And in countless interviews, Margaret would nod in respectful admiration as Walter took credit for the paintings. And this went on for years and years. And so I was intrigued. Why would she go along with this? So I went to visit her. She's 87 now and lives in a sweet house in Napa.
Northern California. And did she go along with it because they were making so much money?
Well, at first he said to her, look, I can't tell people the truth now because everybody thinks I painted the big eyes. And if we tell people it's you, they might sue us. And, you know, people don't want to think that, you know, I have to have my wife paint for me. And so he was telling her all these horrible problems. And so that's where she began to go along with it. But then what happened was he became more and more domineering and abusive. And eventually she became like his art slave. He kept her basically locked up in a room with the curtains closed, just churning out these paintings 16 hours a day while he was outside swimming in his... They now lived in this mansion with a swimming pool in a gated community with servants because the paintings were selling so well. So he was outside, you know, swimming naked in the swimming pool with naked women and Howard Keel and the Beach Boys. And she was inside, you know, like an art slave, churning out these paintings for him.
This was in the 1960s?
Yeah. By then, you see, you know, the American suburb had just been invented, and so people suddenly had a lot of wall space to fill. And obviously lots and lots of people who wanted to express upbeat whimsy in their homes were going for, like, dogs playing poker or dogs playing pool. But the people who wanted their homes to be a bit more melancholic were all going for the big-eyed children. It became this huge fad. You couldn't walk into Woolworths without seeing, you know, racks of these prints.
So they make tons and tons of money. Here she is slaving away 16 hours a day painting these big-eyed children. But finally, she decides enough is enough. And what prompted her to say, I'm done with this?
Well, it was a long time. It was 10 years. And he was becoming more and more abusive. He wouldn't let her have friends. He wouldn't let her go out. He told her that he knew lots of mafia people and he'd have her killed if she ever told anybody the truth. She had this little chihuahua that she loved, and she was so attached to this chihuahua that he'd come home and kick it. And so she had to give the dog away. And he'd come back from his partying and just sort of, you know, yell at her, you know, do more, do one. He'd like demand, do one in a clown costume, do one dressed as a harlequin, do two children on a rocking horse. And so she was like churning out all of these things. And finally, after 10 years of this, they split up. You know, finally she plucked up the courage to leave him. But part of their sort of private settlement was that she'd carry on painting the big eyes for him, and she did about another 20 or 30 of these paintings. And then one day she just thought, you know, enough is enough. I have to stop lying. I have to start telling the truth. And by then she became a Jehovah's Witness, and so I think that, you know, was part of the motivation for telling the truth.
So then she stops painting for him, and so does she go on to sell the paintings herself and do well?
Well, by then, they'd kind of fallen out of favour. Woody Allen mocked them in his movie Sleeper. And, you know, they were kind of kitschy. And, mm-hmm. and so they'd fallen out of favour by then. So she carried on painting. She moved to Hawaii and she would paint these big-eyed children. But now the big-eyed children were like swimming in Hawaiian seas, like in azure seas amongst tropical fish. And for the first time in these paintings, you see these small, cautious smiles appear on the mouths of the big-eyed children. You know, the big-eyed children were so depressed looking in the years that Margaret was like locked up in a room with the curtains closed.
Well, they have enjoyed a renaissance, a bit of a renaissance, at least in hipster culture.
Yeah, well, a few things happened. Some of these kind of anime cartoons, like the Powerpuff Girls, were very influenced by the paintings. And now Tim Burton has made a biopic called Big Eyes, which Margaret's got a cameo. She says she's a little old lady sitting on a bench. Amy Adams is playing her and Christoph Waltz is playing Walter. So, yeah, it's coming out at Christmas and there is a little bit of a renaissance now.
So is she happy now that her story is being told and that the truth is now out and she is the acknowledged artist of this phenomenon?
She is happy. And it made me realize that, you know, that some wrongs are so great that it needs something as dramatic as a major biopic in which Amy Adams is playing you to heal the wounds. So that's helped a lot. I think she feels guilty too. She, towards the end, Walter... It became acknowledged that she was the real artist and Walter was outed as a fraud while he was still alive. She sued him and in court, the judge ordered them both to paint a big-eyed child and Margaret painted hers in 53 minutes and Walter said he couldn't paint because he had a sore shoulder. So in the end, she won. And I think she feels guilty about the whole thing. She said to me, because, you know, by the end of his life, Walter had really become convinced that he had painted the big eyes. He developed what's called delusional disorder, which is it's a really interesting disorder, actually. It's like schizophrenia, but the delusions are plausible. You don't believe like Satan's following you around, but you believe plausible delusions that people believe. Like, for instance, your wife is taking credit for your genius and so on. So he became convinced that he had painted the paintings, and Margaret felt kind of responsible for that, saying, you know, if I hadn't allowed him to get away with it, maybe he wouldn't have got as sick as he got.
Yeah, but he had been so abusive to her and she still felt guilty about that?
Yeah, you know, human beings.
Yeah. So now she's 87 years old. Is she still painting?
Still painting every day in remarkably good fettle, living in this lovely little house in Napa with all her Jehovah's Witness family and friends, painting every day. There's a gallery in San Francisco which sells her work, and I believe the work is shooting up in price now because of the Tim Burton movie.
Mm. So was she able to get any money over the years after she left Walter? And
the judge awarded her $4 million in damages, but Walter never paid any of it because he drank it all away. First partying with, you know, the Beach Boys and Howard Keel, and then finally just, you know, becoming an alcoholic and living in a fisherman's shack somewhere near San Francisco. So she never got any of the money.
Do you have one of these paintings yourself?
She gave me, when I left her house, she got out a couple of prints and signed them for me. So they're sitting in my drawer waiting to be framed and hoping that they've shot up in price because of Tim Burton.
Are they the happy ones or the sad ones?
Actually, they're kind of sad. Mm. They're quite sad ones. Yeah. She said to me, you know, she didn't realize, like, if anybody had asked her back then what her inspiration was, which, of course, nobody ever would have asked her that because nobody knew she was the painter, she'd have said, I don't know, they just flow out of me. But then she began to realize that, obviously, these big-eyed children were expressing her own feelings of sadness and questioning, you know, why is the world so scary? You know, why do people get sick and die? Why do people shoot each other? And I said, you know, why is my husband so crazy? And she said, yeah, why did I ever get into this mess? So that's why the paintings, that's why the children look so sad.
Well, John, it's been fun talking again with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. It's always a great pleasure talking to you.
That's John Ronson. He's a journalist and documentary filmmaker, and we've been talking about Margaret Keane and her big, sad-eyed children. Julie Myers, I kind of like those paintings, despite myself.
Here's my impression. You guys ready to hear it? Oh, well, that's right. The radio.
You do look like one of us. You do.
Not. I'll take a picture and post it on Twitter after this.
Usually it's Grumpy Cat, but
I can do a pretty mean Grumpy Cat as well. I've got rubber face. It's a gift. Too bad I'm on radio. So We talked to the head of LACMA earlier in the show. That's Michael Govan. And we asked him about this major makeover to the LACMA campus. I posted a picture of the planned building on Facebook. Wanted you all to critique it. And you all critiqued it. Thank you. A lot of you did it. And I loved everything about your comments. Mike McGill asks, was the idea to make the building look like a tar pit? Because... mission accomplished. Hernan Monyako says that he loves architect Peter Zumpter, but he saw the models when they were on display at LACMA, and it just seemed the galleries were kind of all crammed into this amoeba morphic shape. It just didn't really quite work for him. Eva Crawford says that she detests the design. She lives in the neighborhood and she says it could not be more ill-suited to Los Angeles and the neighborhood around LACMA. She says she doesn't have words to express how much she does not want this building to happen. And Ernie Silva says, well, if you paint it red instead of black, it kind of looks like Gorbachev's birthmark. So there's that.
Wow.
So there was a lot of haters on Facebook. But you know what? There's a lot of lovers, too. The lovers came out. Plenty of you saw Michael Govan's vision, Peter Zumpter's vision for what they wanted to bring to this area. Eric Mestman says that he loves the design. He says he typically supports historic conservation, but this design really pushes the envelope in a good way. And Michael Govan pointed out that the historic buildings on the property are basically falling apart at this point, so perhaps preservation is not in the cards there. Corey Ford says that he finds the design rather beautiful. Perhaps he needs his eyes checked, but he likes it. And Richard Saavedra says that the design definitely makes a statement. It's easy to mock. It does kind of look like a tar pit. But for those of us who appreciate design, this will be a real treat if it ever gets built.
Okay, lots of opinions there. Keep them coming. That's on the KCRW Facebook page. And you can also weigh in on Twitter at KCRW Press Play or leave us a voicemail, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And Warren Olney, To the Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks a lot for listening. Have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.